The following Real Assets Advisor podcast is a production of its parent company, IREI, Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a complimentary subscription to Real Assets Advisor Newsline and Magazine. Curious about real estate, infrastructure, energy, commodities, alternative investments, or real assets in general? Real Assets Advisor is curated intelligent news, data, and insights to suit your needs. Visit realassetsadvisor.com and sign up today using our new chat feature.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul. We're going to talk about ships, vessels, transportation, containerized cargo, international commerce, you name it. It all comes down to a lot of big steel and some captains at the helm. And we're going to talk about this with our guest, Matthew Freeman. He's Chief Commercial Officer at Vessels Value, where he is in charge of the analytics department. And if you're wondering, what is Vessels Value? I asked myself the same thing, but I ran across a report from them that talked about, and Matthew can check me on this, I believe the report talked about that there's a very high number or even a record number of ships being ship demolitions or recyclings or what have you, that it's hit a very high number. And so I wanted to talk to Matthew about shipping, transportation, the trade business in general, and really all things shipping. What's going on there right now? Because it's such a huge part, such a backbone of our international trade infrastructure and just getting commerce done. So with that, Matthew Freeman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike, and thanks for having me. It's always great to share views with our friends in the States and around the world. They've been such an important part of our journey with Vessels Value and an integral part of our business model. So just happy to share any views that I can with you.
We're happy to have you. Matthew's joining us from London, by the way, if you haven't kind of decoded his... Oh, there's so many Londoners in the United States or Australians these days that you can't, the accent tells you nothing. But he is in London. He is, in fact, in London. And Matthew, we do appreciate you joining us. And let me start with the whole Vessels Value question. What is Vessels Value? What do you guys do?
Vessels Value, well, the concept of Vessels Value came around prior to the global financial crash back in 2007. And that came from a couple of individuals, myself included, and we were ship brokers at the time, buying and selling ships. And one of the things that we always used to get was various reports from other ship brokers, larger ship brokers, that had generic ship values in them. You know, what is the value of a resale ship or a five-year-old ship or a 10-year-old ship. And once the financial crisis hit and obviously caused havoc in the shipping markets and the valuations of these ships that were rising so steadily in the years leading up to it just went all over the place. No one really knew what the value of the asset was. So you had a situation where you had lots of stakeholders, you had lots of ship brokers, or you had lots of investors, or you had lots of banks, or whoever was invested in shipping at the time, looking for information, and it wasn't there. And when you asked all the other big brokers that were meant to be relying on at the time, they just said, "We don't know. We can't publish any values because we don't really know where things are." So that gave us the idea to start collecting data and to start automating the valuation process, because everything has a value. It doesn't matter what time it is. It doesn't matter what the conditions are surrounding the market.
What does that make you guys, an information service?
I guess we're a technology company. We launched the first set of automated valuations. So we now value over 100,000 ships every single day. So the value that you look at is a little bit like Google. You log into Vessels Value, you get a login, and you type the name of a ship in, or the name of a shipping company, and then you'll be able to find out. Initially, it was the value that we started to produce, but now we'll show you where it's been, where it's going, what it's carrying, and you can aggregate that data by asset class sector or by ownership group or by country and cut the data in a lot of different ways. So I would think of us now as the big brother of shipping, if you know what I mean. It's shedding transparency on a previously not very transparent market.
Now, are you literally tracking vessels on the ocean right now? You know how many ships are cutting water right now and where they're heading? Is it that detailed?
Yes.
I know Bloomberg. It is. Okay. See,
yeah,
I know Bloomberg does that. And they sell that information.
Exactly.
Because you can really divine a lot of critical information from that information.
So we have our own mapping and tracking AIS program, which is part of the offering that we give. And you can look at all the different ship types. So you could, for example, on a Capesize, which is a large bulk carrier, it's the largest type that you could possibly get. Lots of those carry cargo out of Brazil to China, but you could go on and you could aggregate the Capesize data and you could see what the congestion levels are in Brazil. So how many ships are waiting or how many ships are actually currently loading or which ones are loaded and where they're going.
A lot of ships waiting right now, correct? Because of all the backup?
I mean, what's happened is that I think one of the things that we're going to touch on is that the shipping market in general, across almost all the sectors, and of course there's always exceptions, it is again having its best time probably since the financial crash. And I think COVID-19 has a lot to say for that. And I think most of that is to do with Asia going completely offline. And there being pent-up demand for Asian goods, because obviously, as we all know, a lot of things come out of China these days and also go into China. And if you take them offline for a bit with all the lockdowns that we've had stemming from the pandemic and suddenly put the switch back on, there's an awful lot of pent-up demand, which has caused a boom in maritime traffic, ship valuations, and most of the things actually that we measure at vessels value. And I would say that the shipping market is probably having its best time since 2007.
You know, and let us not forget the South China Sea and the tensions there right now, where you've got military vessels from Britain, the United States, other countries just plowing through there, basically sending the message to China, you can go ahead and build your navy, but these are international waters and we have product coming through here, and so do you. And never shall anybody interfere with that shipping. So there is a game of there is a testosterone chest beating exercise going on out there. But we'll leave that aside. That's something that's a developing issue. I think all countries in the end realize, hey, we need to have the shipping. This is how we make our living. It's part of our economic power. So let me ask you this, how many ships, and I think you mentioned this, how many ships are on the high seas right now?
Our database, we have 100,000 vessels that are on the water. That really goes, when I say our database, we cover a variety of ships. We cover bulkers, so bulk cargo vessels, anything from 5,000 deadweight up to the big, large ore carriers that Vale and the likes that they have, which can be up to 400,000 deadweight. So very, very big ships. With the tankers, same kind of scale. You know, your very small tankers that do intercoastal journeys up to the very large VLCCs, so the big crude carriers. And some of those are 320,000 deadweight. And then we have the gas market, which is LNG and LPG. You have the car carrier market, which carries vehicles. You have the offshore market, which is a lot of the platform supply vessels, the anchor handlers. That was actually.
So you have 100,000 on the water. How many more are kind of sitting idle right now, ready to that are ready to be put into service? That are just sitting idle, maybe being loaded up right now or unloaded or what have you?
When I said 100,000 vessels, I mean that's in our database. That doesn't account.
Okay, that's the full gamut of
that.
So was I accurate when I during the opening? When I said, I thought I read something from you guys, you put a report out, it may have just been a press release, not necessarily a full-scale report, but I thought it said that demolitions of ships or the recycling of ships, and maybe those are one and the same, it's very high right now. Is that the case?
It is. We actually did a half-year review not so long ago, and that's just when we look at everything up to the July time, see how that's going, and compare that to years leading into this. And basically, the first half of this year has seen scrap up 40%. And we had, I think, around 275 cargo vessels that are sold for scrap.
So 40% of cargo vessels were sent to scrap?
No, it was up 40% on the previous year's
number. Oh, up 40%. Previous okay, I was going to say, wow, that's a lot of shipbuilding that's going to need to be done. So how long does a ship, what's the light average lifespan of a cargo vessel or an oil tanker?
Well, we can actually do that quite nicely because obviously we record all the transactions in our database because they're all relevant to the value. So once a ship is recycled, either the satellite system it has is goes dead, so that's one way of seeing it, or we know the transaction and the price, so that's the other way of seeing it. So we can actually look at the lifespan of all the different ship types and then come up with an average which defines their sort of useful trading lifespan. For the cargo ships, so for bulkers and tankers and containers, it's roughly between 25 to 30 years. For ferries, which is a completely different thing, you're looking at ships with aluminium hulls and sometimes they don't get recycled. You look at maybe sometimes 40 years for ships like that. And then with the drill rigs, so your jackups, which is a big part of the US market, you're looking at 35 to 40 years, so a bit longer.
35 to 40, would that include an oil tanker?
That's an oil rig. So for an oil tanker, it's 25 to 30, so slightly younger.
Okay. So what makes a ship age out? Why do they age at all? They seem like they're solid steel. It just seems like they could go for a very long time. What ages a ship out?
I think it's technology, really. I think if you look at all the different things
that
have been...
But can it be retrofitted? Can't you just retrofit the hull? I mean,
you've
got this basically the chassis, and you can just pull out old technology, slap in the new stuff.
You can do that. It's just costly, and it's sometimes not really worth your while doing it. I think that's the main thing that puts people off. And then also with the charterers, especially if you've got an oil tanker... they want modern ships. So many of the big charterers, Shell and BP, they'll have policies that they only charter in. So they'll only pay for tankers that are maximum sort of 10 to 15 years old. But once they get past that age, they no longer want them. So let's say you ordered a brand new ship with all the bells and whistles that you can fix that to the oil majors the first 10, 15 years of its life. After that, you've got to go looking for different types of business. So not your big oil majors, so different types of charterers. And the older your ship gets...
Oil companies don't own their own oil tankers. What they're doing is just leasing them. They're commissioning people to take them out to basically pick up the oil and deliver it.
Well, some of them do. Trafigura, Shell, and BP, they all have a fleet of tankers, but it's a relatively small fleet of tankers that they own because they prefer to limit their exposure and charter in ships. The reason for that is in shipping, long-term returns on shipping, if you look at it with a bigger picture view, are typically quite low, and that's just because shipping is such a volatile business. So that means you can make massive gains in the short term and then equalize that with massive losses. So if you were to average it out and look at long-term return for shipping, and if you haven't been in shipping for 5-10 years and you're new to it, it's quite a risky business to get into.
When you say volatile, do you just mean that business ebbs and flows, or is there some other aspect?
The price can change quite a lot, and obviously, when you let's say you bought a container ship, one of the ships that carries the container cargo on board. Now, there's a particular type of container which is called a Panamax size of container, and that's 4,000 TEU, so that can take around sort of 4,000 containers on it. And this was 10, 15 years ago, was a fantastic size to buy. And this is what all the German investment houses and all the big container owner operators, they all had these ships. They piled in and bought them. It was massively overordered and a very healthy market. What happened is in shipping, things tend to get bigger and better. So technology advanced, ship designs advanced. And one of the original benefits of these Panamax beam containers is they could go through the Panama Canal. So they'd halve transportation time. As shipbuilders started to advance, they came up with ways of building bigger container ships with larger capacity that could travel the same route. And that kind of rendered the Panamax container not obsolete, but less desirable. So when the container and tramp market was in depression, which it has been in the last few years leading into COVID, these ships were essentially not worth very much. You'd look at a 10-year-old asset of these vessels, and it was probably worth between 7 and 8 million. So her, that was her demo value, her scrap value. And if you look at the same ship today, it's gone up to about 90, and that's happened in 6 months. But you know, what comes up must go down, and I think that probably is the lesson that I've seen in shipping. When I look at all the different asset classes, it's so volatile. So you can invest in something and you can lose a lot of money very quickly. And also, you've got to think that when these ships go wrong or require something to be fixed, it's not something you're not talking a few thousand. You know, a friend of mine bought himself a bulk carrier, and he said every time I sneeze on this ship, it's $50,000. Just as an example of the immense costs it takes to own and operate these ships if something goes wrong.
The parts, so like the Exxon Valdez, it runs aground, gushes oil all over Alaska Sound. Was that ship repaired, and at what cost?
I don't actually know. I think it was scrapped, if I'm totally honest with you. Usually when something like that runs aground, it's never going to get fixed again. So there's only really one destination for it. But if you look at what's
totaled.
Happened...
I guess like the equivalent of a car getting totaled.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. If you look
Let's
at most
go to
of
the
these...
beginning. I apologize for interrupting, but there's so many aspects to this that I want to cover, Matthew. And I find it a fascinating subject, and I think our listeners do too. So you have a new ship being built, your standard large containerized cargo ship. How long does it take to manufacture that? And at what cost? In other words, a company like Maersk, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, would pay how much for a brand new containerized cargo ship? And how long does it take for it to get manufactured?
It's a good one, Maersk. You've seen they've just posted their profits $3 billion higher than they expected. Today, they've come out with their forecast. Okay, I'll just take you through the spectrum. So a ULCV, which is the biggest type of container ship you can get, and those are the really, really big container ships that have been built in more recent times as designs have evolved. They're 23,000 TEU, their nominal carrying capacity.
What does
capacity.
TEU stand for? Is that the number of units?
Yeah, it's a nominal carrying capacity, so the amount of containers that are on board the ship.
And how many are on there? How many containers?
Well, there's 23,000 containers in this particular container design, and they're all capable of carrying X amount of cargo. In a container, you can get anything in a container, TVs or just anything, really. They carry anything.
Grain or whatever. Well, grain, I think, is a separate sort of ship.
Yeah, grain would go in a bulk carrier. But just to give you an example, the most expensive container ship today would cost you $183 million probably per ship, and then the smallest type, which is 1,100, which is called a feeder max, would cost you around 26.
26 what?
20. Sorry, 26 million US dollars.
26 million.
Yeah.
Not to build the ship.
Yeah, to build the ship. Yes, the cost.
Really? Okay.
So if you went to Hyundai,
I was expecting a higher number than that. Okay, so 26 million bucks, that's not so bad when you stop and think about it. But of course, it's basically just...
Ship.
Oh, okay. Well, what about the big ones?
183 million.
That still sounds like a deal. I mean, but I guess, you know, you've got this big chassis, and basically you're just creating a bunch of room to put the containers on it. Obviously, there's a lot of precision work and all that, and then there's all kinds of technology loaded in there. So Maersk would then go, that's what they would pay? Or is that the cost of manufacturing, and then they have to pay on top of that?
No, that's what you would pay, and then you would there's various other options that you can put on top of your... If I went to a Korean shipyard, they would give me their standard design, and they would charge me $183 million. And then I would say, well, actually, I want a scrubber, or I want this particular type of engine. Or there's always extras on a ship. And the extras can really... It's like buying a car. It just depends how many bells and whistles you put on. At the moment, investors and banks are very keen on green features of a ship. So they're very focused on
what are some of the green features? How do you make a cargo or a cargo ship or a oil tanker green?
Well, they've developed eco engines, a bit like cars these days, electronic engines instead of your standard bog standard diesel engines. Then you've got dual fuel engines. Some of them run on LNG or some of them even run on batteries these days. There's new types of wind technology that's being developed. I think
hybrid engines at all, like a car, a hybrid engine.
Yes, but they're running on LNG at the moment as with hybrids. Some of the ferries, which is obviously different,
in tandem with batteries,
running on batteries.
LNG in tandem with batteries. Any solar at all, since they're so big a surface area?
Not yet. Lots of interesting designs. Lots of conferences I go to, I always see a new design for solar powered ships, but I don't really think there are any that have really hit the market and they're a success.
It almost seems like wind power would be possible. That's so windy on the seas and you're generating. I mean, of course, you also would create a ungainly sort of ship because you'd have these, you know, windmills up there.
Well, it can be pretty ferocious out there. So I have seen some wind propelled ship designs, and I think there are a couple of vessels that are actually on the water using that already, but it's not something that's massively taken off yet. It's really just to reduce the carbon emissions, and it's all focused on, you know, engine outputs and things like that in shipping at the moment. Shipping tends to be behind the rest of the rest of the world in terms of technology and progress. If you look at auto cars or different industries, I always feel that shipping is behind the curve a little bit.
Are these autonomous ships these days? You set a course and it just takes you there. I mean, you have to have a captain to intervene if there's a software glitch or whatever, but are these autonomous vehicles?
No, they haven't. They haven't done that properly yet. There's been lots of designs that have come out, or lots of concepts of this that's been going. The most advanced I've seen it is going to an owner's office and they can control the ships remotely from their HQ. But I mean, I think they're kind of running that as a little side project, and that's a small local owner rather than a big ocean-going transportation company, which they really haven't been doing that. Because I guess the implications of getting it wrong, the implications of getting anything wrong, if you're doing it with a car, the implication of getting it wrong is you crash and you kill somebody. But if you do it with a ship, you could end up having a global incident, which is probably slightly more serious.
You could end up with what?
Well, you could end up having a global incident, couldn't you? You could have an oil spill or a big collision or something like that, which is
for the environment. That's if nobody's paying attention.
Yes.
But anyway, let's take a fully loaded, a big cargo ship, containerized cargo ship. Mm-hmm. The value of the product on that is, and this might be an impossible question, but maybe you can give me a range. That thing is carrying how many millions of dollars of product?
Oh, it just depends what it's carrying. I mean, I can tell you the charter rates, which is what these ships are getting fixed out for, which is probably a bit more on point. Because really, with a container ship, it depends what the cargo it's loaded is, and it's very difficult to know on a container ship what all the different cargoes are, whether it's loaded full of Ferraris or whether it's loaded full of paper or whether it's loaded full of what. It's very, very tricky to find out exactly what these big ships are actually carrying.
The high end?
But all we know is how much that the spot market, so the charter market. So what are the operators, what are the MSCs and the big container owners, what are they paying to charter ships from your independent owners? And I circle back to this Panamax size, which is a previously obsolete and forgotten size. That size is now commanding around $200,000 a day on the spot market, which again, these are levels that we haven't seen since in 2006.
$200,000 a day to lease it and
exactly
get your exactly product shipped. You know, exactly. We heard recently that oil got so backed up that they were, and they ran out of the tanks that they hold oil in, were all full up. So they were hiring tankers to just take on oil and just sit there. And they're paying a ridiculous amount of money to have a tanker. It was a holding tank.
Yeah.
For the oil companies. I don't know if that's still happening, but it was happening earlier when there was this big surplus of oil.
You can thank Mr. Trump in part for that. I think there was many things that kind of led to the explosion in floating storage, which was mainly that was last year's story. And there was a lot of sanctioning going on Venezuela and obviously Iran and all the other different sanctions that were imposed. And then there was the oil price wars, forcing the price of oil down to about $16 a barrel. And just by contrast, I think it's up by about 80 at the moment. So it's a very cheap time to buy oil. And if you sat on it, you were in line to make quite a lot of money. So what happened is all these old tankers that would normally go for scrap and normally be obsolete ended up working for floating storage. So they were loading oils from the terminals that didn't have the capacity to keep them. And then they were sailing out to OPL in Singapore or wherever else they were going and just sitting there with the oil waiting for the price to come up. When it came up and the terminals ran out, it went in, sold it for a huge price or today's price or...
Right. So yeah, go right ahead. Sorry, Matthew.
Well, that caused an explosion in the rates, and tanker rates last year for the larger tankers was they were around 100,000 a day, which again they hadn't been for quite some time. But it was kind of the perfect storm that created that. It was also the trade embargoes that were set, which basically meant that there was just a huge shortage of oil. And there was massive demand. And a lot of the producers were taken offline for one reason or another.
We had an article in the magazine last year, in Real Assets Advisor magazine last year, on this very topic. We saw a report on it from a research firm and got permission to republish that. It was quite interesting. So we have investors listening right now. And investors, of course, they look for wonderful opportunities to lose gobs of money and then make all that money back and then some. You talked about how you could lose money very quickly, but you also talked about how you can profit very handsomely. What are the investment opportunities in shipping? If you look at a pension fund or if you look at an ultra high net worth individual or family that wants to play in the shipping business, are there real entry points there? How do you get involved?
Well, anyone could buy a ship. There's no barriers to entry. So yourself or myself, if we had enough money, we could go out and buy one. That's not really the issue. It's buying the right ship at the right time. And typically, the best people at doing that have been the Greeks. But we have seen, because obviously they've been in the shipping market for God knows how long, since time began. But we have seen a few really, really well-timed asset plays by some of the big trading companies that are, you know, very, very data hungry. So they're looking at all the statistics and they're predicting what markets are going to be good or bad based on the data that's in front of them. And then they're making plays on it. Someone that's been quite good at that in the shipping space has been JP Morgan. And they were buying bulkers this time last year when the Vale mine was flooded and basically all the trade dried up and the prices shot down and they ended up going on.
So did JP Morgan make out or not? Or they did make out?
They bought cape sizes, 10-year-old cape sizes for not historically low prices, but not at the bottom, but very, very low. And now they're selling them when the cape market is booming and the rates are huge. And they're going to make, you know, double or triple or quadruple their money. So it's a tricky one. There's always sectors you can do that with. And I look towards some of the other investors in shipping and to see what they're doing. And wind and renewables is obviously a very sellable investment at the moment. And you're looking at some of the big US listed companies. I'm not sure if you've heard of Scorpio, and they've now called themselves Eneti. And that's Mr. Lauro. He was from the Lologhetti family. He's based down in Monaco.
But why are you talking about wind and what else did you say?
I'm talking about wind and wind-powered ships because I think that...
Oh, wind-powered ships. Okay.
And wind terminals and wind farms, because everywhere I look, every time I go out into the seafront and look out, I can see more and more and more of these wind turbines. So, you know, in the south of England where I live, what used to be a nice seaside view is now full of wind turbines. And I think probably the same.
And you can have ships having to dodge the wind farms.
You have ships that can. Well, you have ship. Yeah, you have that. Yeah, absolutely. And then
they also have shipping channels. You're not allowed to put up wind turbines and shipping channels, obviously.
But you have lots of licenses that are being approved now. I think Mr. Biden's commissioning quite a lot of stuff off the east coast of New York, isn't he? Off there.
Yes.
A lot of that coming online. And, you know, it's kind of a rush to be the first people to get in there. And one of the companies that capitalized on that was the guy I was telling you about. And he ended up actually contracting the ships that build the wind turbines. Because he thinks, right, there's going to be huge demand to build these all over the world. So I'm going to be one of the first owners or publicly listed companies to get into this space, because it's a very sellable story. If you're on the public markets, which he is, and he's a master at it, you've got to think about, you know, what your investors want. And at the moment, it's all about being carbon neutral and looking to be looking at green technology. And what better thing than that is wind. It's a very sellable story. So to go out and get money on the public markets, it's a great, great story.
Give me his name again.
Emmanuel Laro, and the company is called Eneti, E-N-E-T-I.
Emmanuel, and how do you spell his last name?
L-A-U-R-O.
Got it. Okay, interesting. So
that was just an example of something that I think will fly at the moment on the public markets and probably has an upside because it's very undertapped. So it's a previously not very exciting market. Now everybody wants to get into it. So all of a sudden, it's the best looking woman in the room. And everybody wants a piece of it.
Don't drink too much. Don't drink too much. She'll get even more beautiful.
Yeah.
And then you'll overspend on it, or you'll get it. You'll ill-time the market. That's an investment tip right there, listeners. Now let me ask you this: because you mentioned the Greeks, and they have a whole history of having a very deft hand with shipping. So if we're looking to invest in shipping, we should be paying a lot of attention to the intel coming out of Greece, it sounds
absolutely
like.
Absolutely. I mean, that's another way of looking at it. One way of looking at it is what's popular on the public markets. The other way is to look at what the people that have been in the industry for a very long time are doing. Simply put, they were buying bulk carriers. They would buy when things are at cyclical lows. So 12 months ago, for one reason or another, it was bulk carriers. At the moment, if I had to say what sector I think was going to get cheaper soon, I would say it's probably going to be tankers. And the reason for that is I think that the tanker market for the first half of this year, especially for your 15-year-old ships, was held up by, I say dodgy buyers. buyers that probably didn't have to adhere to the sanctions that the US was opposing, and that is predominantly the Chinese, because I think probably they were doing trades that they weren't really meant to be doing, but obviously they didn't have to answer to anybody, so they just went ahead and did it.
Yes, they're good at doing that.
Yeah,
so is the United States. But you know, you come from Your Majesty's government, and it's the Royal Navy, and of course we're not talking about military right now, but shipping has been Britain's strong suit for a very long time. What makes the Greeks any better at this than the Brits?
They simply put, they own more ships. The British ship owners, I think if you had to count them now, you could probably count them on, I say two hands, maybe four hands. There's not so many of them, really. I couldn't tell you the reason for that. It's just, especially the ones that are based in London or in the UK, there's fewer and fewer of them, of your big ship owners. I think, in the 90s and the early 2000s, a lot of the Greek companies had their offices here, but they were never British companies. And a lot of the great British companies probably aren't really around in the way that they were anymore.
Is Aristotle Onassis the greatest shipping magnate in history?
I'm trying to think who owns the biggest amount of ships. The biggest private ship owner to ever exist was, he recently died. It was John Angelakousis.
And where was he from?
He was a Greek.
He was a Greek.
He was
wow.
a Greek. He had his office in London for many years and then moved back when became less worthwhile.
So who today, I mean, let's not just think in terms of who has the most ships, but who is the innovator? Like, for instance, who would be the Elon Musk or the Jeff Bezos or the Bill Gates of shipping right now? Is there such a person?
If you're talking about being forward thinking and investing in new technology and trying new things, no, I don't think there is. I think there's a handful of very big ship owners. And some of them are doing some things to improve the carbon footprint of their fleet. But most of these guys have still got your gas guzzlers and your big diesel ships that are earning them a fortune.
So traditional shipping is still traditional shipping, and it's not having huge breakthrough. I mean, there's efforts being made, but there's not huge breakthroughs right now.
Everybody's trying. So the charterers are paying a slight premium on the rates for the tankers, for example, if you have all the bells and whistles and your eco. So that's incentivizing the owners to go out and order better ships and reduce the carbon footprint. But at the same time, for everybody that wants to improve, there are people that are quite happy with what they've got and they're already getting very high returns. So some people are very stuck in their ways. And I think that's the problem with shipping, that we don't have someone that's really doing that to the same magnitude as like you say, your Elon Musk's and people like that.
Wow. Well, the door is open. The door is open to some innovator who wants to come along, who's got the right money and the right connections and the real affinity for technology. You just mentioned... go ahead. Finish that thought.
I think half the problem in shipping is that, you know, nobody really wants to be the first person to do things. And yeah, there are, you know, people who do the odd ship here and there, but no one's really gone into it really, really heavy and said, oh, I'm really going to change the way that shipping's done and ordered a whole huge fleet of, let's say, eco ships. It's been done on a smaller basis, but no one's really taken the bull by the horns. And the reason is that if you're the first person to do something and you get it wrong, that's the end of it.
You second to market oftentimes is the best way to do it. Let somebody else learn the lessons, take the wounds, and then it's kind of like, okay, now we know what not to do and what to do. Now you mentioned returns and you said very good returns. So let's talk about that. I want to get back to investors more directly. So what kind of returns historically have been registered?
All the funds that we're dealing with, the majority of them want something between sort of 10 to 15% return on their money. And it just depends on how you achieve that. Like I said, if you get in there and you buy low and you can sell high and you've done your research and you know the market's going to explode and somebody else doesn't, then if you buy it's five or six ships at rock bottom prices and you can flip them again in that amount of time for double or triple the money, then you're going to far exceed that. That's one way of making a shipping investment, probably the most desirable way, but it's very difficult to get it right. And the timing is everything, isn't it? If you look at buying assets against backed charters, that's another way of doing it. So you buy an asset at a set price to obtain your return, and you get a charter from a guaranteed, you know, blue chip charter at a certain rate, at the rate of return that you want. That's another investment, but that's a steady investment. It's not going to sort of change your world, probably.
It's not a big turn and burn, big windfall.
And then if you go and buy something, you know, at a medium price and you trade it on the spot market, then you're very much at risk. That's very much the ship owners. A lot of the Greek ship owners will do that because they've got the pockets to, or it's just what they've always done. But it's a very risky thing to do if you're a new investor coming in. Into maritime world.
If I was to ask you about shipbuilding, I would imagine there's probably only 2-3 or at most 5 nations that are the big shipbuilders. Is that the case, and who are they?
Yeah, well, England used to have some good shipyards, but we haven't got any left. It's now predominantly Korea, Japan, and China. Those are the three.
Wow.
And we, Vessels Value, we give all the different yards a rating, you know, out of 100. And that's one of the things that defines a value. And the Japanese yards have always been the best. And out of 100, you would score a Japanese yard 100. Because if you construct a ship in a Japanese shipyard, you get the exact design you want on the exact day that you said that you would, that you say you would get it.
Precision.
Exactly. And then Korea is very close to that. I think in the good years back in 2007, 2008, a lot of people thought they would try and do shipbuilding. So you had a lot of new yards that sprung up in Korea, which then the economic downturn subsequently got rid of. And the same in China, to be honest. And then now what you've seen is consolidation. So a lot of the big Korean yards, instead of there being sort of 7 yards, is now 3 or 4. But the Korean yards are equal to the Japanese, if not sometimes in some asset classes, they'd be slightly better. Depends what you're ordering. And then the Chinese, that's really the interesting story. You know, we used to discount those back sort of 15 years ago. Some of those were discounted by up to 40%. And now I would say some of them, you know, 15 years later, are either very, very close to the Japanese or Korean standard. And in some case, for different ship types, they could be better. So the Chinese have learned from what everybody else is doing and come back and improve. And now they've got cheaper prices and designs that are just as good or very close to being just as good. So they've really changed.
I have to ask you, are you a seafaring man? Do you have a, are you a sailor? Do you have
Absolutely
a yacht?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. No,
I have no background. You don't spend any time on the water.
No.
So you don't spend any time on the water.
No, and I had no background in maritime. It was just something that I came across. I was languages
but,
actually.
But how did you fall into the soup here?
I think I graduated at a time when the market was booming, and I found who is the majority shareholder of Vessels Value. He was he's been shipping for 40 years. He was at Clarkson's in the 70s. And then he left to form a company called Braemar in 1984, and then left there in 1993 to form a company called Seashore. And I joined Seashore in 2006, and the market boomed straight out of university.
Did you say you were studying languages, though?
I studied French and economics, yeah.
Oh, French and economics. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to ask you about the outlook for the shipping business going forward. And as I look around the world and I see these rising middle class, I mean, rising economies in Asia, and not just Asia, but around the world, but particularly Asia, and the ability to share information and technology because of the velocity of information, the internet, the satellite communications, 24/7, all that sort of thing. I would imagine the shipping business, it's nothing but clear sailing ahead.
I think shipping as an industry is becoming more transparent, and it's definitely getting more mainstream coverage. I think on the public market, shipping had a pretty rotten reputation, and I think in the last couple of years, especially this year, that's really changed. And I think a lot of the equity analysts in shipping are now back at it and really giving some good ratings on the shipping stocks. I think also the mainstream press, you know, all the tabloids in the UK now, and I'm sure it's the same in the US, are commenting more and more on what's happening in the maritime world because it's becoming more and more transparent. And obviously, it's what maritime trade is one of the major things that makes the world go round. So it's changing. It's becoming more out in the open. And I think that the markets, certainly the ones that I'm following and that we follow at Vessels Value, most of those are on an upward trajectory. There are exceptions, but everything seems to be pretty good. I'm looking at the net fleet growth, you know, and obviously that was very slow during COVID. It was around 2%, and that, you know, that's taking into consideration ships added to the water and ships removed. We've got a little bit more of a net growth this year, and that's really, again, I circle back to the container story. There's been 349 container ships ordered this year. Last year was 41, and the year before that was 59. So, you know, we've got a market that's high performing exceptionally. You've got record asset prices, you've got record charter rates, and that's due to pent-up demand, mainly for goods from Asia. But, you know, to counteract that, you've got a big forward order book that's building. So all those ships are going to hit the water at some point. So I would suggest really that what goes up must come down.
Well, if we have 100,000 vessels today, how many do we have 25 or 50 years ago?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, significant.
The number's going up though, right?
Yeah, exponentially going up. Yes. Yeah.
So in the next 25 to 50 years, we're going to have a lot more than 100,000 out there.
I would suspect so. Or we're going to have fewer, bigger ships, which is the other way to look at it.
Yeah.
Because that's what everybody's building. Bigger is better, I think, is what people seem to think. So the standard designs. I look at some of the ship designs now that we cover, and we have this sort of comparison table. You look at all the different sizes and how they've changed. And for example, a Panamax, which is a kind of a mid-sized ship, they used to be 60,000 deadweight, in some cases 55,000 deadweight in the 90s, and they're now 82. That's the standard size. So everything's getting bigger. So I wouldn't necessarily say there's going to be a lot more ships. You could have, I think you're probably going to have a steadily rising fleet. I wouldn't say it's going to quadruple or whatever, but you're also going to have evolutions in ship design.
So we haven't even talked about pirates on the high seas, the Somali pirates and other pirates, and Tom Hanks coming in to save the day. But that was a big problem we don't hear about so much anymore. Is it because, and I think part of the issue was, here are ships coming through that really have very little in the way of a crew, because you don't need a big crew on these containerized cargo ships. Mm. And then you have these Somali pirates. So I don't want to smear Somalia, because it's not just Somali pirates, I don't think, although many of them came from there. They get on board and they take it over. And then it's a ransom situation. Then they were talking about having military type escorts. Is that what's happening now? Why has the story gone away? Has it just become an old story and we're not reporting it? Is it because there are escorts these days? Or is it because there's new technology that prevents this from that wards off the pirates?
I think it's a combination of all of the things, really. I think the pirates are getting ever more sophisticated, and you don't necessarily have to take over a ship these days. You can hack into someone's system, can't you, and destroy that and hold them for ransom. It's you can have technological warfare, which you can kind of get on with. Let's say you hacked into someone like Maersk's system, and you could hold them to account for many different things. But I mean, piracy still exists. Of course, it does. It's probably not reported on as much, I would say, at the moment. I see cases, it's always something going on. But I think that also you've got increased security in the main piracy areas now. And then you've also got tools that people can use to counteract that. So AIS satellite tools that tell you where and where not to go, or you can see, you know, these ships coming in sooner than you'd be able to see before. So I think probably that the market is just getting a little bit more intelligent. And they're having to find different ways to extract money out of people is probably one of the things I would say.
Wow. Matthew, you know, we're pretty much out of time, but I do want to ask you, what else do our listeners need to know? Maybe what have I overlooked, or what would you point to? What is happening in shipping that an investor or even a dilettante would find interesting or important?
Shipping is such a broad topic. Again, I go back to the asset classes that are probably the most attractive to buy. The big story last year was cruise ships, and the amount of money that the cruise companies were having to borrow. I mean, I forget what Carnival borrowed. It was something like $23 billion. And whereas we're all recovering from COVID now and the world's trying to get back to normal, the cruise ships really aren't where they were. You had Richard Branson that piled into these ships and was sort of spending... I forget how much he spent on the Scarlet Lady, this big luxury cruise ship he bought. It's $800 million, something like that. But people are still quite scared to go on them. And I was looking at assets that have lost the most money, so therefore probably the most interesting to invest in. And the story last year was, you know, these older cruise ships that were 25, 30 years old, which still got some life in them, that were asking in December 19, $100 million, and then they were sold for 10. So I think they probably had to have some upside. I still think they do. I think some cruise ships are back sailing again, but certainly not the whole fleet, and certainly not full capacity. So I still think there's upside to invest either in the cruise companies, whose stock prices have taken a battering and they've recovered slightly, but I still think there's an upside there, or in the actual assets themselves, which some people have been doing. I think there's some positivity there. And then if I was a betting man, I would bet on the tanker market coming back down again, because I think some of the more creative buyers that existed 6 months ago.
You'd short sell that market.
Yeah, I mean, cruise ships and tankers, I think if I was going to invest my money in anything, well, in shipping, is what I would say.
But cruise ships, you're saying that's the upside. They're going to go up. You're saying tankers, you could short sell those because they're going to drop.
Yeah, just hold your horses and look at those in 6 months' time. Because the rates are negative, but the asset prices were held up by creative buyers who I think have since exited the market for one reason or another. So that just leaves your vulture buyers that are left looking at these sort of 15-year-old tankers, and that means there's going to be a correction in the prices, because the tanker rates certainly aren't supporting the prices that are currently earmarked out there.
So those 100,000 vessels that you say are at sea now, those include cruise liners?
Yeah, cruise liners is not a huge asset class. It's maybe 500 and 600 ship types. 500 or 600 ships on the water. So it's a very small asset class.
What's your life expectancy?
Cruise ship, we can keep going up to 40 years.
Wow.
In some instances longer. You can get these classic ones, or they get converted to hotels or casinos or whatever. They definitely have a longer lifespan.
Gotcha.
Because the tourism industry, as we all know, you know, there's more people traveling the world, or there was before COVID, than ever before. So it's just gone up exponentially. And to cope with that, there's just been more and more cruise ships that have stayed in circulation.
Our guest has been Matthew Freeman, Chief Commercial Officer at Vessels Value. Matthew, this has been a really interesting discussion. It's been a wide-ranging discussion. I hope that you will keep us posted on any kind of milestones that are hitting the shipping business, these sorts of things that our audience should be apprised of. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. And thank you for having me. Very much enjoyed it. And any chance to share views is greatly appreciated. So thank you very much for that. And I hope it was helpful.